Welcome back to Bedtime Tea with Paula. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I know we haven't had a few episodes in a while, and as I said to you guys, the reason for that is I'm very pregnant, and I'm in that weird stage of pregnancy where you just don't know what's happening. 37 and a half weeks, I've had some prodromal labor, so it's like, could I have my baby tomorrow? Could she come in 3 more weeks? I have no idea. And so I'm kind of living in limbo these days. I've had a couple of iron infusions because I was super anemic, and that's helped a ton because I was exhausted. Like, I truly realize now how insanely exhausted I was, now that I'm like, oh, this is what it feels like to be normal again. And you know, I'm super uncomfortable and all the things. So just me complaining about pregnancy. But I just wanted you guys to know. And, you know, again, my goal with this podcast is to keep it real, to just be myself. And so it's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be timed well every single week. But I do want to bring you good topics and people that I care about. And this episode, I am very, very excited about. So today I am sharing with you an interview with Dr. Greer Kirschenbaum. I'm sorry if I butchered that, Greer. She is a neuroscientist and a doula, and she is just one of the great minds in the conscious parenting, gentle sleep, holistic parenting space, I guess. She's just one of the big ones because she has such a relevant educational experience. She studied, you know, you're going to hear from her, but she studied neuroscience and mental health and all of that, which is super relevant. And then also she has the doula side of it. And it's so rare to have people who kind of have training in a very hard science and also soft science, soft or nurturing skills at the same time. And she wrote a book called The Nurture Revolution: Grow Your Baby's Brain and Transform Their Mental Health Through the Art of Nurtured Parenting. I got my hands on this book. It comes out June 20th. So if you're listening to this, I think it'll be tomorrow. June 2023. I think every parent should have this book, 100%. And there is an audiobook version, so you can listen to that if you prefer to listen to things. You can buy it on Amazon, anywhere you get your books. Just look up The Nurture Revolution. I truly, truly believe that this is like, it needs to be one of those quintessential parent books that like every parent reads. Forget about What to Expect and whatever other nonsense books are out there. Because it really gives you the basics of brain development, how your brain, your baby's brain grows, how your brain changes in parenthood. I almost see this as like the whole brain parent. If you're not familiar with The Whole Brain Parent by Dr. Daniel Siegel, I think that has been a really quintessential book. This is sort of the new wave of that. Just a lot more nuanced and nurture based, and it's just really, really good. And so we get really into that in this episode, which you're gonna hear. I'm not gonna go on too long because I think there's plenty to listen to, but thank you guys again. As you know, you can find me on Instagram at Paula Morales McDowell. You can let me know what you think of the podcast. You can give me your feedback, good or bad. I want to hear your thoughts. You can tell me what you want to hear about next. And I share all kinds of free sleep advice, but really I talk a little bit about everything because that's just who I am. Come hang out with me on Instagram. And thank you again for supporting this show. And I promise I will be back with more consistent content once I get out of this baby having phase. Without further ado, here is my interview with Greer. Hello. So I am so honored to have Greer here with me today. Greer, can you please give us a quick introduction to who you are and what you do?
Yeah.
Which is a lot.
There are many things. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm so happy that you have this wonderful podcast to share on these important topics that we're both interested in. So my background is in neuroscience. I studied neuroscience in my undergraduate degree. I have a PhD in neuroscience and medical science, and I was also a postdoctoral fellow, also studying in neuroscience. Throughout my career, I studied learning and memory and mental health as like some of the biggest topics, and how our genetics and our experience contribute to form mental health. And as it turns out, a lot of that is formed in these first 3 years of life, right? From conception to age three. So that's kind of my specialty. After my academic career, I was trained as a birth and postpartum doula, partly in a way to sort of figure out, how do we get this information to families? I was so driven to do it. And I just love that work. So I've been a birth and postpartum doula and worked with infant sleep as well for the past almost 8 years. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing. It is. I mean, I love what you do, because it's so rare that we have people who come from that science, very sciencey background, and sort of get into like the more working directly with families and nurturing families. And, you know, there's such a disconnect. And I think that's a topic that I'm always talking about on this podcast, is like, how do we combine science and nurture and intuition and these sort of soft skills that aren't as valued in our culture. So I just absolutely love what you do. I think it's so important. You're the first neuroscientist doula, right?
That
That's,
I know.
Pretty cool.
Yes.
That's a pretty cool claim to fame.
And the first one to sort of be bringing this information, you know, directly to parents. I mean, I so agree with you with the translation of science to the public. It takes decades to happen, and it happens in really passive, indirect ways instead of just really directly talking to people. And the scientists doing this work, they're like deeply passionate about it. Like, it is, breathe it. But, you know, that work is incredibly intensive, right? So it doesn't always include the advocacy. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And then, like, how do we make changes if we don't get it out to the people that matter, which in this case, I guess that's what your book is doing. So tell us about your book that's coming out on next week, June 20th, right? Perfect.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think of, you know, as a PhD student, postdoctoral fellow, a lot of my goal was develop a new pharmaceutical, new medication that could help anxiety, depression, addiction, chronic stress, like just help the suffering I see so many people are experiencing around me and I experience myself, right? We're all part of it. And my, this book is
the medicine.
The medicine. It is like that's this thing I was dreaming of. It's actually, you know, teaching families, you know, the basics of nurture for themselves and their babies. And we know, you know, if we can start to spread this message, have more people using nurture or interacting with it, you know, that is the medicine, right? So my book does a big overview of the infant brain, you know, how it's so incredible and special in the first 3 years, the parent brain, how that changes. And then this, you know, more than the second half of the book is how to nurture. Mm-hmm. So, you know, six different topics of how to nurture in all the states that we find our baby in. So I'm really passionate about like nurture being the North Star. I felt like that when I had my own son.
Yeah.
times where you're overwhelmed or just tired and you're just like, what do I do here? You can just return to nurture. And I would always be like, yeah, I know exactly what to do. It's just going to be a little, I need to take care of myself maybe so I can get there. Right.
I love that so much. And I got your book. I started reading it, and that really was it. Just everything resonated with me so much, because something that I love about it is that there's both complexity and simplicity to it, right? So you are giving people the science and the nitty-gritty, and like people want to know these days. Like I get questions all the time, like, can you show me? Can I share an article with my partner about this? And can I, you know, how do I explain this to my mother-in-law? And you know, people want the science and they want to understand the why. But at the end of the day, you also need that simplicity so that when you're in that moment, like your newborn is crying and you don't know what to do, you need it to be simple. Because I think that's the issue, is like we have all these parenting methods that just complicate things, right? Like I'm thinking like the five S's. I still can't even remember the five S's half the time. It's just so complex. Like you need to follow these little methods to soothe your baby rather than observe the human being that's in front of you and like know what they like. You know, it's just like prescriptive stuff, and you're not doing that. You're giving people the information and the education, but at the end of the day, it comes back to nurture your baby. Like it's just
Yeah.
that simple, which I
I
love
love the
that.
way that you've just said it. Like, it's really about, encouraging parents to return to being in the relationship with their baby and just return to that connection in all the moments. Because, like when you have scripts to say or, five steps to go through or, whatever it is.
So stressful.
That's taking, yeah, it's stressful. It's like, how do I remember this? I can't probably. And also, that's taking us out of the brain states that our babies need us to be in. So our babies need us to be engaged in our sensory and emotional systems. And those to-do things, all those shoulds, all the stuff that's outside of the relationship, those are engaging our motor circuits and our cognitive circuits, right? And we want babies mirroring our sensory emotional states, right? Not the other. So that's a very important distinction.
So interesting. I am super excited, and I'm currently expecting my second baby, so I'm like excited to binge this as I, you know, get to connect with this new little human. Because that's exactly what happens, is you start, I think parents, you know, you have a baby and you just want to do it right. You want to give them the best start, right? And there's so many opinions about what is right and what is not, but ultimately, I mean, yours is coming from neuroscience. Like literally you are understanding what grows brains, and that I think is extremely valuable. There's definitely some more sort of in-depth questions I want to ask you, but I wanted to mention one of the things. I'm a weirdo. I'm really into like true crime stuff. And lately I've been listening to a lot of like cult podcasts and like, you
I'm so
know.
interested in cults,
Are you?
psychology.
It's just like fascinating to me,
Yes,
right?
it is.
And that obviously what always comes up is the way that children are raised, and the way that children are raised in this very controlling, very, you know, respect for authority, a lot of abuse, a lot of, you know, basically break them down until they comply. And it's sad because what I noticed, like I always sort of look at the parallels of like, yes, okay, there's some extreme cults obviously that are very, very abusive, but so much of that bleeds into just society in general, right? Like it's, you know, like like other people follow it as a general rule. And so you still hear, like, it boggles my mind that you still hear things like, if you hold them too much, you're going to spoil them. Or, if you pick up your baby every time he cries, he's going to learn that you're going to pick him up every time he cries. And I'm always like, duh. I know the whole point. I mean, I don't know. I guess my question is, and obviously I know that this could be very long, but how did we get here? Like why are we in this spot as a society? It is truly kind of mind-boggling to me.
It does, when you put it that way, it does seem like it's this thing that's totally spiraled out of control, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in the early days when I started this work and I was talking about it with my friends and family and all this stuff, they were, you know, they were like, oh yeah, like babies are treated really badly in like some of these really like cults or like, you know, these extreme circumstances, right? Like a lot of the studies we know about the, you know, the brain come from orphanages where babies like didn't have a lot of emotional connection and things like that. But I was always like, no, like those are really extreme. And like, of course I deeply care about those babies.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about regularly, like
all of us.
Average
baby.
Like exactly. All of us.
Yeah.
Right. That all the people I know, some had some bits of nurture, but not the whole package. Right. And then, you know, you see, that was like such a big part of my motivation when I left science and my friends were having babies and I started hearing this stuff, like how strong it all is, right? I kind of had an idea, but I was like, really? And I'm still amazed. I'm still, I have a client and they're like, yeah, our doctor said we have to put the baby to cry for 20 minutes every day alone in a bassinet. So they learn how to do that. I'm like, you know, I know this is everywhere, but I'm like, oh, right. We still haven't really, anyway. So
yeah. And it's coming from people who should know better, who you would expect would know the research. And
exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, so the answer to the question, where does it all come from? I'm sure there's, I actually am searching, I'll announce here, like, is there a PhD student out? Because this is a whole PhD, right?
Yeah.
Like, where does childism come from? Sarah Aucoin-Smith's writing a book on childism right now, where I think she is going to go really in depth in the whole history of all this, which is really exciting. But yeah, it sort of seems like it started around the Industrial Revolution, where people were starting to work these like 9 to 5 days or maybe longer. And, you know, we weren't, you know, there was no time for nurturing anymore. There was no people, they wanted people working, not nurturing.
Yeah.
So, you know, around this time, we start to see these like, you know, pieces. So there's some in the UK, there's some, you know, in the States, like Emmett Holt, like in the early 1900s, his book was like 1910, you know, followed by many, many other books. And I think the thing that's interesting to note about it is like these, you know, kind of doctors or authorities, right, were probably people who never had a deep intimate relationship with a baby, definitely didn't birth a baby, and are starting to tell mothers and parents how to do it, right, with these like very shaming, dismissive, you know, emotionally neglectful practices. And I remember I told my friend years ago about this. She was a lit major and she's like, yeah, because like those were the people who got to write books. And she's like, I wonder, were like grandmothers ever given that opportunity to write a book about like how they didn't do any of that? And so that's probably it, right? That these people in power got their voices out, and it is so deep into our psyches now.
Yeah. And I mean, I think like the whole like sleep training industry started around that point, or not the industry, but like the whole idea of sleep training started. But I think it's also, it has been around throughout history. And I think it goes back to control. I think just like most things, right? It's control. It's keeping people quote unquote in line, right? Yeah. It's part of white supremacy, it's part of colonization. You can't colonize if you can't control people, right? And so, and we've seen it throughout history, I think, in cultures where, you know, nations who are prone to like war, like you want to raise good soldiers. To raise good soldiers, you need them to not
be
emotional
thinkers. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
So
And I think the other interesting thing I do talk about in the book too is like the way that we are parented changes our DNA. It actually changes our DNA that influences our nurturing behavior. So if we have this low nurture, right, if one human does, right, from these systems that's been so powerful, that person's going to grow up to have a similar parenting style.
Yeah.
And that is how it's been passed on and on and on until, you know, someone breaks it. And I think
It's
That's
so
the
hard.
exciting thing is we're the first generation to try to start breaking it too. I mean, not the very the first, but I feel like the movement that's happening, you know, with all of the people who are so active in this space now and have voices on social media, which is so exciting. We can really like liberate a lot of parents who just don't feel that way about babies or are aware of their experience and don't want to do that. But yeah, we're the first generation to benefit from the past 30 years of genetic revolution, neuroscience revolution. We have so much information behind us now
We
that we never
do.
had before.
And it's hard because it's like we're doing that work of breaking those cycles that I always say, like, I just hope my child has less to heal from than we do, right? Like, that's all I can hope for, because we're not gonna get it perfect.
The first person who's breaking the cycle is going to have the biggest burden of work, right? Because that's not, you know, how we were parented, and we're asking this generation of parents to parent in a way they weren't parented.
Work
And
through
that's
triggers
the
and
biggest, right? And so like we are, of course, we're going to be triggered. Of course, we're going to have to do so much mental work. Like it is exhausting, right, to do this if we didn't have that experience. But you're right, then the hope is we're, you know, setting up our babies to have different epigenetics, different
I
markers
hope
in
so,
their brain, a little bit easier for them, and then maybe even easier for the next, right?
That's exactly it. It's like the work of healing our future generations, and that's why I love, I think your book is going to be so instrumental to bring that to parents. So I love that. Gosh, I have so many questions to ask, but I think something that really strikes me, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about. Okay, so let me start this. Trying to like, how do I gather my thoughts here? Let me start this way. I've actually talked about this a lot in my podcast because it's like my biggest gripe with the sleep training industry, is the whole concept of self-soothing. And I saw in your, so I was reading your book, one of the things you have is, I think, 30 something myths. And one of them is self-soothing, of course. And I would love to know your thoughts on it from a neuroscience perspective. Like, what's happening in the brain? Why is it that babies cannot self-soothe?
Yes, love this question. It's emotional to talk about because it's pretty serious, right? It's a very serious thing. You know, just for people listening, like this could have happened to you as a baby, and you may have done this to your baby. And to just sort of say, you know, for everyone, like we have so much compassion for that because
100%.
this is normal in our society. Like this is like you brush your teeth, you sleep train your baby. Like unless, you know, like unless it's like you've been opened up to the other way, like this is your
What you
best.
do.
It's what you do.
You give
Like
them their
that's
shots, you sleep train them.
exactly. So, and you know, that is one of my biggest hopes is that we can update the knowledge of pediatricians and all of the people who are really influencing this, right? They need to know neurobiology, and it is within their scope to know it. So,
100%.
okay, so let's start with what is self-soothing, right? So we talk about self-soothing, babies need to learn to self-soothe, blah, blah, blah. You know, what it really means is self-regulation. Okay, so the word self-soothing and the reason why sleep training thinks babies can do it, it comes from a paper where scientists observed babies like in their natural state of sleep, right? So they were observing them. They saw that some babies would wake up, look around, rub their head, suck their thumb, something like that, and then drift off back to sleep. They called them self-soothers, but they were not doing self-regulation
Yes,
because they
exactly.
were not in a high state of stress. They woke up, they remained in a low stress regulated state. And then they went back to sleep. Okay. So that's what self-soothing is. Then there was babies in the studies who woke up, did have a stress response, and called out, "I need help. I'm feeling stress in my body and I need someone to co-regulate me." And in that study, they were called signalers,
Signalers, right?
right? And so Now, sleep training says we can teach babies to self-soothe. There's no evidence for that anywhere. It does not exist.
No, but everything is built upon that foundation, which is just like the shakiest foundation there ever was. Like
it is. Parents need to know that.
Yeah.
Those babies in that study, they were not self-regulating. They were not going from a state of high stress to low stress on their own.
Right.
Yeah. And that is the key, right? And so when we understand how the stress system works, we understand that babies are unable to self-soothe or self-regulate. Mm-hmm. The babies who actually can, who like wake up low stress and go back to sleep on their own, they're not regulating. And that's part of their temperament. Like that's how they are. They can't be taught. Like that's, congratulations.
Lucky you.
That's cool. But it really takes a lot of babies a long time, to get there, right? Yeah. Because they do need so much from us.
What I often teach families, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like for me, it's the opposite. Like if you want your baby to get to that point where they're waking up and they're happy and content and confident in their space, is you respond, because you teach them through many, many, many instances that if they need you, you're coming. And so I always say that, like, your child just needs to trust you. And so then when eventually they wake up and they're like, oh, I'm actually like, I'm cool. And like, I know my parents are nearby and they'll come if I need them, but I don't really need them right now. I'm not going to call for them. I'm just going to go back to sleep. Like that only comes after you've taught them. Like if we're talking about teaching, you've taught them that you are reliable and that you're able to come. Does that make sense?
Yes. That the nighttime is safe because whenever they do need co-regulation, they can have it.
Yeah.
Right. You're associating nighttime and needs at nighttime with safety and being responded to and having access, right, to being regulated. And that is one of the biggest things that babies are looking for, right? That I know if I need help, they do need help lowering their stress. They are unable to do it. They don't have the brain parts to do it themselves. They rely on us. I say we're like an external brain to them. They need to borrow our brain parts, our mature brain parts, to lower their stress. They are unable to do it on their own, right? And so, day and night, they need to know that they have access to that external brain. It belongs to them in some ways, right? Like in those early days. Absolutely.
And that's challenging. And I know that that what you just said right there is super triggering to some people. I know I've come across that on social media a lot. They're like, that's just, you're asking too much of parents. Parents just cannot be there 24/7. And to me, I think it's always like we're putting the blame on the wrong people, because really, why are we in a position where we're in a culture that you can't do that? Like as a parent, like, I'm not saying you have to be available 24/7, but you should, like, a child does deserve to have access to a caregiver 24/7. Like it just shouldn't be a question, but because we've created this paradigm in which it is a thing that like they can quote unquote self-soothe and whatever, then we don't think that that's a must. It's a need. It's not a want. It's not a nice to have. It's a need. Right. Uh-huh. And so, it's frustrating because I understand why it's a triggering thing to hear when you're like, I don't have the capacity to give that to them.
Yeah.
But I think that's, again, it's like the chicken or the egg, right? Like we have to acknowledge these needs before we can better our society to provide that support to parents.
Yes, exactly. I think that's it. I think the other reason why nurture is so hard, why this learning about the infant's brain can be so hard, is exactly that, right? Like, people who took care of babies a long time ago, it was like distributed, right? Like you would have family around and friends around and all that kind of stuff. And like, one person was not meant to take care of a baby 24 hours a day. That is hard.
It's impossible. Yeah.
Even two people, it's too hard. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yet the facts are the facts, right? Like they do need that presence. And so I just encourage families to be like, listen, you know, this might feel hard at first, be asking for reliable help from people in your life, mm-hmm. Or investing in that, yeah. You know, but it is so important, right? So, I mean, I do wish that, you know, one person would not be responsible for a baby for mm-hmm. 24 hours a day, or even mm-hmm. two people. Like, it's at least three, right? Yeah. You know, I always say that. Yeah. That's like, one's taking care of the baby, one's resting, one's cooking, cleaning, shopping, laundry, right?
Ideal. Like, the more I get into this world, the more I'm like, can I go live in a commune with a bunch of yes. like-minded parents? Yeah. Let's just all do it together. For sure. And I mean, that could be like you said, it could be daycare, right? And I think yeah. I also see there's like a whole, I'm curious your thoughts on this, because I see a lot of stuff, especially from like attachment focus parenting people, about like daycare isn't necessarily the best, or like, you know, it's better for kids to be with their parents. But mm-hmm. in my mind, I'm looking at it. So from my perspective, for example, like my husband and I, because of the world we live in, we used to live in Toronto. We couldn't live in Toronto. There's just no way. So no. We're away from family and it's just us two. And so my son is in daycare, and like, even when I'm not, even if it's not because I need to work, it's just like for my mental health, I need him to be in daycare. Like, I need him out of the house
yeah.
because I don't have that village of people to care for him.
Yep.
And so I do wonder, like, I feel like I think there's a lot of just sort of like extremist sort of views on these things that aren't looking at the nuance.
Yeah. It's such a great topic. So I think before I had my own child, I was probably more militant.
Yeah.
And through my birth and postpartum doula work, I really got this, right? Because I was brought in, especially as a postpartum doula, to really be supporting the mom, or the, you know, the in every case, actually, I always supported moms, and sometimes they're the dads are partners too.
Yeah.
And one of my first clients, you know, she had me, she had lots of nighttime doulas, she had a nanny, she had more than one child, and it was, she had three children. So it was her third baby that I was helping her with. And, you know, she like, you know, I was like, I'm, you know, could see she could like rest and like have a massage from, you know, me or one of the other people helping, or, you know, it was a very privileged situation. Absolutely. Yeah. And it was also so beneficial, right? And, you know, she said to me once, she was like, it takes a village, Greer.
Yeah.
Like, I am so grateful for you. I am so grateful for every other woman who is in our life right now, okay. helping yeah. her family.
Yeah.
And that those words stuck with me. And so, you know, understanding that, a nanny, the people at daycare, friends, family, they are all so capable of also nurturing your baby, yeah. being a significant person in your baby's life. My son has fallen in love with tons of people at daycare
yeah. and
some nannies before that. And like, why can't they be part of this village that are, you know, helping raise our children, right? Mm. I think in the more extreme parts, it's that really intensive parenting idea, right? Where it's like, it has to be all me, because like my relationship's the most important, and me all the time. And that's true. Even when other people are involved, you're yeah. still most important.
You still are. Yeah, exactly. You don't lose your place. That's
yeah. They're still person. Getting so much out of that relationship with you.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd be so afraid of people burning out so, you know, badly, right? If they weren't yeah. getting this kind of help. Yeah. And we can do some, like, hopefully we have some influence that like the plate, like either a nanny, caregiver, or daycare is going to be responding to our children's emotions and their stress, and
100%.
Helping them with their sleep in a way that's like comfortable for us. And if that's
ideal,
that is ideal. And if it doesn't happen, you know, you're still the one you're still nurturing through all of it, right?
Yeah.
You're still the most important person.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm glad. Yeah. It's good to clarify that, I think, because there is so much pressure. And again, and I think you even mentioned this in your book, I know this often comes up, is like the whole idea of attachment parenting and how it's very prescriptive, like baby wear and bed share and do these things. But what we really know, and I'm sure you can speak to, is like, it's not going to look the same for every family, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I was actually amazed. Like some of my, you know, most crunchy doula friends in the beginning, they were like, oh, I can't, you know, I get so bullied in attachment parenting groups. They are so strict about all of the parts, right, being followed. I don't have any personal experience with it. I didn't really experience any of that, but I heard that from people. I was like, wow, that's so interesting, because there's a million ways to be a parent, million ways to, you know,
nurture
a relationship with your baby. And I don't think anyone should be telling anyone what that, you know, should look like. Right. And
like I had a friend who was like, shared a picture of her kid in a stroller, and somebody was like, you should be baby wearing because it's good for their, and it's like, what? Like, now we're shaming parents for having kids in strollers? Like, it was the most wild thing I've ever, but studies show that baby wearing is so great. And it's like, okay, but like, you don't know anything about that child and that situation and that family. And, you know, I really found baby wearing, and I'm going to try it again with obviously number two, but I found it hard. It was hard on my back. My baby was born in the summer. Neither of us liked that. I'm very sensory sensitive. So like, just the idea of like being hot and sweaty, like all the time, I just hated it. So I didn't do it, but it's like, I still nurtured my child. Like, it is so weird to me to like stick to one thing because research says so.
Yeah. I love that you bring that up. And I think that's another thing that like I hear online a lot as well. If I say something's good for a baby or a parent, then it's like, couldn't do this because of this or that. I'm like, that's cool. Like, I'm sure you did a million other great things, right?
Yeah. So, but you're not going up to people and telling them like, you should have done that, like, you know.
Right. But I think a lot of people are, right? Like, you know, to each other, like you said, that's probably what some of what my friends were talking to me about, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Criticism. And that's it. It's like, there's so many ways that conception, pregnancy, birth, infancy can happen. So many variables that can happen.
Yeah.
We're so different, all of us. It's not going to look the same. And just because something's good for nurture or good for a mom or a baby doesn't mean every single person's going to do it. Like, you're not going to, none of us are going to be able to do all of the things. We have to like know the information and take in the ones that are going to work for us.
Yeah, for sure. No, I love that. And that's exactly what I saw in your book. And I think that people will get that from it. I wanted to ask too, so you said that your kind of your main topic sort of throughout your studies was learning and memory. And I love that, because one of the biggest, I want to say weapons that the sleep training industry uses is this idea of memory and learning and cognitive development. And I'm constantly having parents ask me like, you know, am I ruining my child's development? And I'm always saying to them, like, if your child isn't getting enough sleep, you'll know. Like, there, you're gonna know. It's like so unlikely, unless you're actively like keeping your kid awake or like they have a health condition, that your kid isn't getting enough sleep, right? But it's used as that weapon. And I've had people say to me, well, like, maybe it's just better if I sleep train them, even if there's possible harm to their brain, because at least they'll sleep and they'll get better learning and whatever. So yeah, I mean, what, and I know we cannot say that sleep training is always inherently harmful, but what can we say about that experience, particularly with extreme like cry it out methods and whatnot, that could be harmful to that development?
Yeah, I think all of those claims made by sleep training industry about babies have to sleep like whatever it is, 7 to 7 with like these crazy long naps and like certain schedules or their brain isn't developing properly. There is zero information that is completely made up out of thin air to sell things to people. Yeah,
I know, it's wild.
Wild. Like, have you met a baby? Like,
yeah.
That's literally not how babies.
Not to mention, like, the average baby doesn't sleep 12 hours a night. They sleep like 10 hours a night. It's like the average. So it's like, okay, so all babies are sleep deprived.
Right. Yeah. And so that, I mean, the number of hours is made up, and the brain development stuff is just a total scare tactic, right? Like, that's, there's no evidence for that at all. There is evidence in older children, way past baby years.
Yeah.
That, yes, if they're not getting enough overnight sleep, there are effects on their learning, cognition, all that kind of stuff,
right.
Just like there are for us as adults, right? And so that's not hard to address. You just kind of want to have a more structured bedtime routine and bedtime for your older child, right? Yeah. Instead of having them stay up too late, right? But for babies, no. Babies' bodies are, because they don't have the TV, the things, like all the stuff that distract children and adults from falling asleep, they are in tune with their sleep physiology. And when they feel sleepy and tired for a nap, they send us out cues and we can offer a nap.
Exactly.
With bedtime, right? I also like to give parents that chart, the National Sleep Foundation chart, just to show, like,
oh yeah, I love it.
Same variants.
Yeah.
Like up to 8 to 10 hours.
I just recorded a podcast about low sleep needs kids, because that was my kid. And that was like the best thing I ever found, was that chart, because I was like, oh my God, finally, you're not telling me he needs to have 2 hour naps, because he wouldn't. Like, he just didn't need them.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think what we do when we sleep train, going back to that stress response, right? Is babies are signaling, going into a fight or flight stress response in their body.
Right.
After that, they go into dissociative state, a shutdown state, and a sleep state. So they're entering sleep through stress versus entering sleep through co-regulation, parasympathetic, rest and digest nervous system, which is the state that we ideally want to be entering sleep, right? So sleep training does not change the duration that babies sleep very significantly, like maybe 15 or 20 minutes. It does not change the number of times they wake up. So it does not change their sleep architecture. So their sleep is unchanged by sleep training largely. The difference is that they are not signaling for that time, right? And so instead of waking up, feeling stress and signaling, you know, we presume, because again, we still need way better studies on this, that they're waking up, feeling stress, but they're not signaling. They're just going to go back into sleep through that stress state, right? More evidence for this?
We need, for sure.
We do need, but when we do respond again, right? For people, if people have sleep trained and, you know, they learn new information and don't, you know, want to continue that, or people even just see this in their regular life, right? If baby gets sick or goes to a different environment, because the sleep training is very paired to the environment that it happens in. Babies will signal again, right? So they haven't learned to go to sleep better, go back to sleep. They've just learned to stop signaling in a very specifically trained place.
Yeah. And we see that because I constantly talk to people who are like, we did Ferber, whatever. And then we went on vacation and it all went out the window. We have to retrain. And why did it go out the window? Because you had to respond to your child because you were in a different space and maybe you didn't want to disrupt other people, whatever. And what's frustrating to me is that it always goes back to this idea of like the child's being manipulative. The child is being bad. It's something that needs to be trained out of them rather than they are literally just having a need.
It's survival for them, especially the really young ones, right?
Yeah,
completely. So yeah, I do see it as, you know, it's just so much misinformation. I think if parents knew, then maybe, you know, they would have the option of making an informed choice based on real facts.
I think so. And again, we understand that there are sometimes you need that result, right? Like you need, like, again, because we don't have a village, because parents are stressed. There are parents who might just be like, I've had parents say to me sometimes, it's like, I know what it does to their brains, but like, I am so tired and I have no support. Like I might choose this as the best option. And I'm never, we can't tell families what to do, but at least you know what's happening.
Completely. Everyone's able to make a risk, like a risk benefit analysis for themselves, right? Yeah. If you are given the facts, same with all the things we decide in pregnancy and birth and, you know, babies, childhood, like every decision we make is risk benefit, right? We just, I think everyone deserves to know the information before they make a choice.
Yeah. And I want to, and again, I want to tread carefully with this topic because I know that it, again, it can make people feel bad, but I want people to understand it because I think this idea that like a quiet, calm, agreeable child is best is really kind of the root of the issue here, is because we think a good baby is a baby who doesn't cry, who doesn't call out, who doesn't. And, you know, people will say, well, if sleep training is so bad, how come it works? Mm-hmm. Or how come my baby's happier now, or like less, cries less? And it's like, what can you say to that? Why are those kids supposed or might seem happier?
I mean, I think a lot of it is the parent's bias.
For sure.
Because it's all based on parent report, right? There's no actual data on what, if the baby's mood has actually changed, or if the parents are like, oh, they're smiling now, I'm going to, you know, I see that more and I'm going to celebrate it more because maybe I don't feel great about what happened.
Yeah.
Right. So there's that bit. And then, yeah, I mean, if we ignore, dismiss, and shame babies and children for having stress in their bodies that we don't want to help them with, emotions that we don't like, fear, sadness, anger, then they are going, you know, develop strategies to suppress them because they are, like I said before, they're always needing access to us. Yeah. And so if they can't have access to us while they're showing us those emotions and stress, then they develop strategies not to show them to us while they're still experiencing them. And that, you know, can seed a lot of mental health struggles that happen.
Right. And that's what I was wondering, because that was sort of your line of work. Like, I guess that is what, I mean, that is what we see. We see anxiety, we see depression in our society, and how often people sort of chug along, and it always sort of strikes me how often we see these like situations of people who seem happy, who seem like they have it all together. And, you know, we see, you know, trigger warning cases of suicide where we're like, oh, but nobody knew. Everybody thought that person was so happy.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and I know that's an extreme leap maybe for people, like, oh, like, you know, maybe sleep training or like how we treat our child, but that is what's happening. Like, we're wiring their brain to understand that, like, don't show your upset, suppress it. But the problem is you can't get rid of those negative feelings by suppressing them, right?
Mm-hmm. And so much of the work I do with families, so much of the teaching in my book and courses and everything, is we have to, as adults and parents, we have to start to learn to be comfortable with our emotions, because many of us grew up in these, what I would say, called like emotional deserts, where we were told, this was my experience, like even unconsciously or consciously, like, we don't like that. We don't want to see your emotions. We don't want to see the crying.
Give you something to cry about.
Yeah. We love you when you're happy. Like, we love you when you're good. We don't want to see the other stuff. And it takes a lifetime of concentrated work and healing and coaching and therapy to unlearn that stuff.
Yeah.
And start to be like, hey, I don't have to be that afraid of my emotions. I can feel them. I can learn that they can pass. I can learn how to, you know, regulate and process my emotions.
Yeah.
I think as parents, we need to learn that, so then we can start accepting the full range of emotions and stress in our babies, and not
have
an instant reaction to shut it down, distract away.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff.
And I love that, because I'm sure, and I, you know, one of the things we talk about a lot is co-regulation. And I think people are starting to understand that. And obviously from a brain perspective, they sort of borrow our brain. Is that how they borrow our calm, correct?
Yep.
So, but then what I also see, and again, I always sort of see the extremes that you see like out there on social media is that idea of like this calm parenting where like you're like Mary Poppins and you're just like always like, you know, the word unruffled kind of like triggers me. It's like this idea of like you're so calm and you talk to your kids like that. And to me, I just don't know that that's helpful either, because then you're not showing your kid that you're a human being with emotions and feelings. And like, you know, and I often will have this conversation with friends and I have to remind myself of the same thing, right? Because, you know, my friend would be like, oh my God, my kid, you know, they peed on the floor or whatever. And I like yelled at them and I'm the worst parent ever. And I'm like, yeah, but like you stepped on pee. Like that's like a pretty human response to yell when you stepped on pee, you know, like, and you can acknowledge that like they didn't do it on purpose, but also acknowledge that you're a human being with emotions. And so, yeah, I I'm interested in your thoughts on that because I just feel like it gets sort of to that extreme.
Yeah, I love that you brought this up. And I talk about this in my book too, because we have to learn, you know, often we will learn how to deal with our emotions and even just the awareness that we have them when we have children, because they're bringing them up in us every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the parents I work with, like, we talk about this. We're like, you probably made it up to this point with coping strategies, distraction, addictions that took you away from ever feeling emotions or feeling them much, right? And when you have kids, there's no escape. Like, you can't do those things anymore. Yeah. And so, yes, I do believe that our children seeing us experiencing emotions and processing them is important, because we didn't get that modeling. We need to show them that they need that modeling in a way that's appropriate for kids too, right? They, you know, we can show them, hey, listen, I'm having a big emotion right now. I am so angry. And that's my emotion and I'm going to take care of it. And
It's not your fault. You didn't make me have this feeling. Exactly.
It's not your fault. This is my feeling. And, you know, what am I going to do? I'm feeling so angry. Like, I'm going to like jump up and down and move my hands around like this, right? I'm going to take some, and then maybe after that, I'm going to take some deep breaths. And, oh yeah, you know what? I've noticed that emotion has now passed through me. Mm-hmm. Maybe that emotion's telling me something about what I'm needing right now.
Right.
Like under our emotions, there are needs. Under our baby's emotions, there are needs.
Yeah.
And so there is like a mirroring learning going on.
Yeah.
I will also say, we already talked about this. Like, we're the first generation doing this.
Yeah.
So we're going to be emotional, about all of this stuff.
Well, that's why I say, like, yeah, is it ideal that you like screamed at your kid because of something? Like, probably not, but like, is it a normal response based on your upbringing? Probably.
And yeah.
At the very least, did you apologize and try to repair? Then you're already doing better than what you got.
Exactly. And that's exactly it. I've said things and lost it, you know, in ways. And so is probably every single parent on earth. Ever, right.
Yeah.
It's part of it. It's part of nurturing too, because when we do show them repair, that's teaching them about emotions and teaching them about humanity and the world and how that works. Right. And so if your sudden reaction is like, what happened? There's like, I'm stepped in pee, and you have like this big reaction. Like, later on, once you regulated yourself, your child's calm as well, you can say, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Like, I stepped in it, had this big reaction. Maybe I yelled at you.
Right.
That's not, you know, that is not my, you know, what I would have chosen to do. Like, I don't think it's right for mommies to yell at babies.
Yeah.
I'm going to do my best next time to do something different. I'm really working on it. And I just want you to know that wasn't okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try something different next time. Right. Yeah. And so that keeps you in the relationship. It keeps everything honest and teaches your kids a lot. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. And that's what we want. Like, we want them to know that that's okay to have that, because they're going to have those moments. Right. And like, we had a funny situation a few weeks back where we ordered pizza. I shared about this on social media. I thought it was like, so like such an illustration of like how 3-year-olds are. we ordered pizza. My son loves pizza with pepperoni, but we order from a new place. And already he was kind of off about that because he like likes to go to the specific pizza place with his dad and pick up the pizza, whatever, right?
Yeah.
We open the pizza and this particular place, they chop up the pepperoni like in small pieces rather than like the circular that we're used to. My son lost it. And it was like this like 30 minute screaming like he was dying. And, you know, it's hard as a parent sometimes not to not laugh, but just kind of be like, are you freaking kidding me? Like, you know, but it was just so funny because at the same time, and as I was sharing with people, everybody was like, oh my God, I'd be pissed if you got my food wrong too. Like how often do you go to like drive through and you get the wrong order and it ruins your day? Right. Yeah. And so I think, yeah, like showing them that we can have those big feelings too. And like, you don't have to be ashamed about it after. You don't have to like feel like, oh my God, I lost it. And now like everyone hates me. Like it's fine. You just had a feeling and it passed.
It's such a good example because in those moments, you know, especially if there's been many of them in a day, which there often are, and that's dinner time. So it's probably been all day, maybe. Then you just want to be like appealing to their cognitive brain saying like, it's the same food. Like
that was me at first. Yeah.
It will be the same, right?
Try it. Look, it's delicious. I'm like trying to convince him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when you can realize when we're emotional, that part of our brain shut off. Right. Exactly. And so appealing to the feelings of like, I see you're so, so disappointed. Like, I get it. Like just what you said, when I get the wrong order, I feel the same way. Like this sucks. This is not ideal. Yeah. Right. Like I'm here for you.
And that was what I noticed. And again, like that's a practice for me because even though I know that that's the right way to react, it's also hard for me because right away, I'm like, no, it's the same thing. Don't worry. It's fine. We'll get the other one next time. Like, just eat it, blah, blah, blah. And as soon as I started being like, hey, you know what? Like, that sucked. You really wanted to go with Dada to pick up the pizza and it was the wrong one and it looks funny. And oh, that just sucks. You were really looking forward to this pizza. As the moment I saw him calm down, like the moment his body was like, okay, you get me. Mm-hmm. And then we decided to get, like, we just picked out the pepperoni and he didn't eat the pepperoni. And that was that. He was happy and he was fine. But it just like, it's hard for us even to get to that point because we weren't taught that way. Right. So, and your logical brain is thinking like, this is so dumb. Like, why are we having this discussion?
Completely. It's such a good example. It is. And yeah. And then the other thing is, even if it doesn't make them calm down, it's still a good approach, right? And they can still be so upset. Like, think going back to like what we were just saying, like how much do we still have a tendency to like suppress our emotions, not fully feel them, not fully express them, right? We have so many barriers there and defenses and programming, right? And our kids are just like, I'm feeling it. Like mm-hmm. I'm expressing it, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's that going on too. And so I also teach parents in those moments to just kind of be like talking to themselves and their kid at the same time and be like, I am here for you. Feelings don't last forever. And like, I'll be here, you know, as long as this feeling is here with you and it will be over. Right. And we have to remind ourselves that.
I'm so glad you said that too, because that is a thing that I hear a lot is like, well, I tried to co-regulate, but it didn't work. It was like, what do we mean by work? Right. Like, and I think again, is going back to that like passive, agreeable child.
Yeah. We're emotional. Humans are emotional. And it's like, we don't want to see it.
No, right? No, it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we see that. And yeah, exactly. We're like, I still get triggered all the time when my son gets like he, I don't know, he's trying to do a puzzle and he gets it the wrong way and he goes, and he like freaks out and I'm like, why are you freaking out? Like, and then I'm like freaking out at him.
Yeah.
It's not helpful, but it's like, yeah, even things like that, it's like we just sort of expect them to be calm all the time. And again, even those of us who are in this field and who are understanding these things, like I can cognitively understand it, it's still so much practice every single day.
So much work in the moment. Like my son's 4 and a half now. I still have that those reactions too when he's frustrated doing something.
Yeah.
Always like, it's fine.
Just try again.
Exactly. always have to take a pause and be like, okay, let's see what's really going on here.
Yes.
You know, yeah, it's hard. It's hard work.
So hard. What I guess to sort of wrap things up, and I know you do a lot of amazing work, so people can follow you. I'll put your Instagram handle and all your stuff in the description. What are you most hoping people get out of this book?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think the big message of this book is I really believe that nurturing the next generation can change the world, because when we nurture as we have been in our extremely low nurturing ways, you know, as humans for the past 100, 200, maybe even more years, we're shaping babies' brains to grow to be reactive, right? What does that mean? A tendency for more behaviors that are impulsive, aggressive, and destructive. And we see that happening in a lot of places in our world right now. And if this next generation can grow up with nurture, that will grow their brains to be regulated, tend to be more regulated. And what can a regulated brain do? Have empathy, compassion, flexibility, creativity. And that's what the world needs. And so, but for all the things I care about in the world, I think it all starts with a nurture revolution, like nurturing this next generation, getting all the parents and doctors and perinatal practitioners together to unite with this movement.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you call it a revolution. Like, it's just so like, because I'm so big on like parenting is political, and that is what it is. Like, we are literally shaping the future of our communities, our culture. Like, we, you know, I only hope that my raising just my son is going to make him be a better citizen, so that he can look at, like, he can spread that nurture to other people and do better for the world, right? And I really do believe that's how it passes down. I think a big part of it is we need to move past the quick solutions and past the, is this working in the moment, right? People say, oh, gentle parenting doesn't work because those kids are like out of control. And it's like, well, are they? Or are they being human?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's it. I think the revolutionary part is very important, because it both shows how huge a change we need to make from low nurture to high nurture. And it also tells us how, like, revolutions take a lot of work, a lot of sacrifice, you know, and a lot of focused attention.
Yeah.
And that is also required.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I love this so much. I hope this becomes like, I really see this becoming like a, well, it is a movement, but, you know, just like a, I hope this is like a thing that everybody reads and everybody has, because I really truly believe that that it's that foundation, is just understanding like why nurture is important. I think it's everything else is just noise after that. You know, we can learn how to bed share safely, and we can learn about wake windows and schedules, and we can learn about how to teach our kids math, and like, we can, that's fine. But if you don't have that base, like, I just think everything needs to come from that.
100% agree.
Yeah. So thank you for writing this, and I hope people get this book. Is it available in audiobook?
Yeah, there's audio and a digital.
Okay, amazing. Is it you narrating it?
It isn't.
Okay.
Someone else who's incredibly talented at, narrating. It's an art.
That's amazing. No, that's fine. Yeah, I like audiobooks because I'm, you know, busy parents. we like audiobooks. So that's good to know. So people can get that, I guess, on Amazon, anywhere you can get books.
Yes, absolutely.
Perfect. Perfect. Oh, I am so thankful that you came here to chat with me today. I could talk to you all day and ask you a million questions, but
thank you so much. Such a pleasure to speak
with you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. And I look forward to people letting us know what they think of your book and what the what results come from it. So I'm excited.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here, and enjoy the rest of your summer, and I hope everything goes really well.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.